Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. You might well think that the worlds of law and poetry are so far apart, it would be almost impossible to occupy both. However, according to one of our guests this morning, James Elkins, he's professor of law at West Virginia University, he says, from our earliest days as a nation, we have had lawyer poets and poet lawyers. In this part of the show today, we'll talk a little bit about the intersection of these two worlds, and we indeed do have two guests. Joining us by phone, James Elkins. He's professor at the West Virginia University College of Law, has been there since 1981, has also served as editor of the Legal Studies Forum since 1996. He has taught courses on law and psychiatry, lawyers and film, lawyers and popular culture, and a number of others. He also became interested in the work of lawyers who published poetry back in 2000 and was editor of the first compilation of the work of poet lawyers. It's titled Off the Record, an anthology of poetry by lawyers. Also here in the studio with us is Carl Reisman. He is an attorney here in Champaign-Urbana, has a practice where he does work on workers' comp and personal injury. He is also a poet. In fact, was a poet before he was a lawyer. He has a bachelor's degree in economics from University of Illinois, started into law school, then wasn't sure that was what he really wanted to do, made his living as a cook for a while, and then went back to law school in 1993 and got his law degree from University of Illinois. He has authored two poetry collections, Home Geography and Kettle. They're both published by Hot Lead Press. The first in 2005, the second in 2007. And he also is the organizer of a symposium that will be taking place on the U of I campus tomorrow and Friday on poetry and the law. And here are a number of people coming from around the country. Our guest, James Elkins, is supposed to be here. He may make it here, he may not, but the symposium is going on in any case, and we're really glad that both of them could be here to talk with us. Our number, if people who are listening want to call in, be involved in the conversation, 333-9455. That's for here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Well, here with us on the telephone is James Elkins, Professor Elkins. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us. And here in the studio with us, Carl Reisman. Thank you.
Good morning. Hello, David. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Carl.
Let me just start by asking how it is that it occurred to you, I'm talking here with Carl, how does it occur to you to want to organize this event, to bring together these two things, poetry and law?
Well, last summer I came across the work of Jim Elkins just by chance. I was doing a Google search of the words poet and lawyer, and came up with Jim's amazing compendium on the web called Strangers to Us All. And Jim has done biographies of every lawyer poet he could find and links to their poetry. And I thought it was an amazing thing. I had written poetry and practiced law for 10 years, and I was not aware that so many other lawyers published poetry. I wrote to Jim just to ask if I could link up to his website. I was putting together a website for my office, and the correspondence just went from there. In talking with Jim, I found that he'd been interested in gathering up some lawyers who wrote poetry, but had never been able to do so at West Virginia. And I thought maybe the University of Illinois College of Law might want to do something like that. And I thought possibly it would be an interesting intersection with the new creative writing program at the university, too.
So this event is taking place here, and you have people coming from around the country, some local writers I know, and also some people who are coming from various points around the compass. One of them, maybe... I'll be our telephone guest this morning. But let me turn to him then. And I also have taken a look at the website here, and it is a very impressive list of writers. For example, there is one index that's just chronological, and the first person on here is someone named Thomas Morton, who was born in 1579. And it's a long list. And certainly there are people on this list that are well-known names in American history, people who were members of Congress and senators and members of the Supreme Court and so forth. What, Professor Elkins, what got you interested in this idea of going out and looking for lawyer poets or poet lawyers?
David, I came to this in the strangest sort of way. I am not a poet, and my reading in poetry had been really quite thin. And in the summer of 2000, I started working on a rather obscure writer named John William Corrington. And Corrington was a LSU English professor, and he had published an acclaimed first novel and published several collections of poetry, and I think was on his way to becoming a quite good poet, when at age 40 he went to law school. And so it was thinking about Corrington. Corrington went on to practice law for 3 years at in New Orleans, and oddly enough, then abandoned the legal profession after he had abandoned a promising literary career and took off to Hollywood to write TV soap operas for the last 10 years of his life. And once I found Corrington, I knew that I had found a very, very interesting writer. I started reading his work, and his stories that he had written about lawyers and judges, I thought were some of the most profound that I had ever read. And so I knew I wanted to write about him, but to write about him, I had to deal with this odd dissonance in his life. That is, that he was a poet and then he was a lawyer. And so there's something quite jarring about those, about the stereotypes, really, that we carry around in our head about poets and about lawyers. And so it was really in trying to think about Corrington and what it meant to be both a lawyer and a poet that got me started.
Yeah. Let me turn back here to Carl, because I certainly think that it is true that the law is an occupation that we love to hate. We love to say nasty things about lawyers. I'm really not quite sure why that is, but it is. Why? I'm sure you have reflected on this, being a writer and a lawyer, about why it is that people have such a low opinion of lawyers, and the idea of someone being a poet and a lawyer. I'm sure the reaction of a lot of people is to say, well, that's just it. Those two things just don't go together.
Well, I think on the problem with lawyers, I think one interesting thing about lawyers is that they are so much at the center of everything in American life and American culture. And they have been, quite literally, from the very beginning. Lawyers early on were very much a part of the literary culture in this country. In fact, when you start looking at the early history of the United States, you see lawyers everywhere. They were poets. They were our early novelist, they were our early literary figures, and so they had this kind of central place. In fact, the configuration of law and letters in American culture is really quite interesting. And I think we basically come around to the idea that this is all history. That is, that this was true in the 19th century, but it's no longer true today. And I think that's the common conventional way of thinking about this. And I think one of the things that I've discovered in my work is that there is a kind of strong underground antinomian stream of lawyer literary figures in this country. We know them in popular culture as writers of legal thrillers, people like John Grisham, who's one of the most popular writers in the country. Illinois has one, Scott Turow, who actually turns out to be a very, very good writer. And so they're known in popular culture. Interestingly enough, the lawyer poet never really quite disappeared. And I've now identified something like well over 500 lawyers currently in this country who actively write poetry and who publish their poetry.
Hmm.
That's a long way around. I still haven't managed to say anything about why lawyers have dug themselves into the hole that they have in terms of public opinion and the perception of their worth, but perhaps we'll get back around to that.
Well, I'll give Carl a chance to talk about that. Why do you think that generally speaking, people have a fairly low opinion of lawyers, and the idea that a lawyer could be a writer and a sensitive observer of the world? People have a hard time putting those two things together.
Mm-hmm. Lawyers probably have a bad reputation for a number of reasons, some of which are deserved, and some of which I think are the result of a certain amount of propaganda to keep people from exercising their rights and using lawyers as tools to help them. Most of the a lot of people who have a bias against lawyers find it when they actually need one that they're quite helpful, and their biases were wrong. But I think it's complicated. I think there's so much power that lawyers have in this country. I think we tend to fear people who have a lot of power, we don't really understand the law as well as we should. We give up a lot of power to attorneys, and sometimes the attorneys abuse the trust of their clients. And in those sort of cases, lawyers really do deserve a bad reputation.
Mm. Well, I suppose you would argue that one of the most important tools that any lawyer has is language, and that indeed is the tool that the poet uses. So perhaps that it's not so surprising that we should have lawyers who were writers of various kinds who like to work with language, because that's what lawyers do.
The tools are the same, and a lot of the tactics are the same. I think that poets and lawyers both engage in argument in their work. Poets have audiences, lawyers have clients. And I think there's a certain kind of similarity in the responsibility that lawyers have to their clients and poets have to their audiences. And I think some of the mistrust that people have of lawyers and their frustration with poetry is similar. When lawyers look out for their own interests and forget their clients, clients get very frustrated and angry with lawyers. When people read poetry and they feel like the poets are just self-involved and aren't interested in communicating anything interesting, people get frustrated with poetry and stop reading poetry.
Hmm. Well, I've had on and off the opportunity to talk with poets on the program, and I'm sure that that's one of the things that sooner or later we get to, is the idea that I think that a lot of people are perhaps put off by poetry or have a difficult time with poetry because they have this idea that somehow this is a code. It's a personal code of the author, of the creator. And if you had the opportunity to sit down with that person and quiz them, maybe then eventually you could find out what the poem is really about and where it came from and what those images mean and how they connect with each other and all that sort of thing. But that I think a lot of people, for them, poetry is just impenetrable. They don't get the chance to sit down and interview the poet. And maybe even if they did, that it wouldn't help. And I think that that's why perhaps more people don't. The audience for poetry, while there is an audience in the United States, it's pretty small.
It's true, and I think that poets should look at their should be honest with themselves and appreciating why that audience is dwindling, and think about what people might want to get from poetry that they don't get from other kinds of experience, other kinds of writing, and what they might be able to do to make people love poetry again or help people love poetry. I think a lawyer should be able to communicate with their client. A poet should be able to communicate with their reader. It doesn't seem that complicated to me. If a poet is inscrutable, maybe it's interesting for a linguist, but it's not interesting for a reader.
David, I think one of the problems is that since people don't tend to read poetry the way they once did, I think probably in the 19th century, 1860, 1870, 1880, you would have likely have found a poetry anthology in virtually any literary person's house. There would have been reading of poetry. There was poetry published in newspapers and journals that were being read by literary people of the day, literate people of the day. And so there was a great deal of accessibility, and people were commonly reading poetry and seeking it out. And generally, readers don't do that today. And what happens is that then when we do see poetry, whether it's in The New Yorker or a literary journal or wherever, it may very well be poetry that doesn't speak to us directly. And one of the things that I've found, in fact, I would have subscribed to that notion myself as a reader. And so there is a kind of barrier there for many of us, and we don't know how to get past that barrier. And the thing that I've found is that once I have a lot of poetry before me and I began to find poetry that matters to me, that I can read, that I feel that it's accessible and that it there's no code there to break, the poet speaking directly to me, the poem speaking directly to me, then I find that it's possible to find, locate, and discover poetry of all sorts that I can read and appreciate. But it takes getting through that initial barrier, and I think for most readers, there's simply not a chance to do that. And I think if you go pick up a major anthology of some sort, that might very well not happen. You might read 20 or 30 poems you might read for 2 or 3 days and still come away feeling like that there was nothing there in the world of poetry that was calling you as a reader. Mm. And so for me, I feel quite fortunate because, and it, as perverse as it may be, I have basically found poetry by way of the lawyers, because in looking at their poetry, I began to find poems that I could read and love to read. And so now I've become a fan and a devotee of poetry. Mm.
Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in here in the last 5 or 10 minutes, talking with us here on the telephone, James Elkins. He's professor at the West Virginia University College of Law. He is the editor of the first compilation of the work of poet lawyers, Off the Record, an anthology of poetry by lawyers, and that came out in 2004. He's also taught courses and published articles in a variety of subjects, including law and psychiatry, lawyers and film, and lawyers and popular culture. He is one of the invited guests to come here to Champaign-Urbana to take part in what may well be the first ever conference on poetry and the law, taking place here on the campus of the University of Illinois at the law school. And here in the studio with me, one of the conference organizers, Carl Reisman, who's an attorney here in Champaign-Urbana, has practice, and he's also a poet, was a poet before he was a lawyer. And he thought, well, that'd be a good thing to do, to get people together to talk about the worlds of writing and the worlds of the law, and how indeed those two things can and often do come together. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call if you'd like to give us a call. I'd like to ask Carl here to read something. He has published, has two collections, and read something for us.
Sure. I'd love to. Actually, first I'm going to read something that's not by me, but by Edgar Lee Masters. He wrote the Spoon River Anthology. It's a book I've kind of taken a look at again after reading it in high school. And Edgar Lee Masters is one of our lawyer poets. He from Illinois. He was Clarence Darrow's law partner and had quite a long and distinguished legal career and literary career too. And I found this poem interesting as a workers' compensation lawyer because this was written in a couple years before the Workers' Compensation Act was passed in Illinois, and it touches on what happened to workers who were injured before workers' comp. At that time, you would have to sue your employer and prove that they were negligent. If you couldn't do that, then you were out of luck. So this is called Butch Weldy, and it's from the Spoon River Anthology by Edgar Lee Masters. After I got religion and steadied down, they gave me a job in the canning works, and every morning I had to fill the tank in the yard with gasoline. that fed the blow fires in the sheds to heat the soldering irons. And I mounted a rickety ladder to do it, carrying buckets full of the stuff. One morning, as I stood there pouring, the air grew still and it seemed to heave, and I shot up as the tank exploded, and down I came with both legs broken, and my eyes burned crisp as a couple of eggs. For someone left a blow fire going, and something sucked the flame in the tank. The circuit judge said whoever did it was a fellow servant of mine, and so old Rhodes' son didn't have to pay me. And I sat on the witness stand as blind as Jack the Fiddler, saying over and over, I didn't know him at all.
Wow.
And I think that's one of the interesting things about reading this book again is just the connection between poetry and justice, too. It was a revelation to come across that poem in this compilation, and something that wouldn't have meant much to me before I practiced law, but means a lot to me now.
Yeah. I want to have you read something of yours, but just real quickly, and I'm moved to ask James Elkins, having looked at now the work of a lot of lawyer poets, do many people actually write about something that seems to come out of their practice or legal issues, or is that just, yes, occasionally writers like Edgar Lee Masters, but mostly they're writing about things that are completely different, and you wouldn't read the poem and think this person might be a lawyer?
Surprisingly enough, quite few of the lawyer poets actually devote any of their poems to law or to lawyering. There are a few that will sometimes write such a poem, but I think certainly this is true of the contemporary poets, and I think it holds historically. I've now put together a rather large library of poetry by lawyers and have examined hundreds and hundreds of volumes, and you can go through an entire volume of poetry by a lawyer poet and have no idea that the person was in the profession. So I think it's not a rare or unusual case for a lawyer to write about law or lawyering, but I think it's fair to say that most lawyer poets, when they set out to do poetry, are setting out to be poets, and they write poems about the kind of things that poets write about. Hmm. They do not basically focus on law and lawyering. We do have a long history in this country of lawyers, real amateurs, writing what's called legal verse, rhymes, lyrics, lyrical, I don't mean lyrical work, but limericks, humorous works, and that sort of thing. I think it's fair to say that legal verse has played no significant part in the history of poetry, and is generally viewed with disdain. So it's simply not figured prominently in any sort of way, either in the lives of lawyer poets or in poetry more generally. Hmm.
Carl, is there something else that you wanted to share at this point?
It's interesting that Jim says that. I was looking at the anthology called Poetic Justice that the law school put out for years, and actually some of the years I was there, that was poetry of law students, and almost none of that was about the experience of being a law student, which was very different from a friend of mine's journal from medical school. The University of Illinois Medical School for about 15 years put out a journal of poetry and short stories. It was all about being a doctor and learning to be a doctor. It's completely different, and I can't really explain why that is. It seems to me like there would be an awful lot to write about.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I have a caller here who has been on hold for a bit. I don't want to make them wait too much longer, so why don't we go ahead and bring them into the conversation. Someone who is in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Hello. Fascinating discussion. I'm in my 70s, and I remember when my little boy, first son, was born, I read him the Beatitudes, and he said, "That's beautiful, Mom, but the world doesn't work that way." And it's true. My question to you is, how to make the real world work that way? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, that is a large question, one that's worth thinking about. I'm not sure, within the context of this program, We can crack that one. Have you got, Professor Elkins, have you got any thought about that?
I'm sorry, I wasn't able to hear the caller very well.
Well, okay, so the caller was talking about when she was a young mother and had a child that she read the Beatitudes, and that this child was, I guess, wise beyond his years, because he said something like, well, that's nice, Mom, but the world doesn't work that way. And so the question she raises, yeah, how do you move the world more in that direction?
Well, one of the interesting thing about poets, it seems to me, is that they help us see the world in a much clearer, deeper, and more profound way than most of us day-to-day are doing for ourselves. So I think our poets are great seers. They are visionaries not only of, you know, some greater ideal. We think about poets as sort of being up in the clouds somewhere. But as it turns out, I think what we find in the poetry that I find most meaningful is poets dealing with very, very real world stuff. The most real sort of thing that that we can find. Let me read a poem to you.
Yeah, please.
This is by a poet named Joseph Caldwell, and he's a bankruptcy lawyer in Charleston, West Virginia. It's called The Kanawha Trail. November's morning sun uncovers frost-covered spider webs crisscrossing the trail. A purple sweet gum angles over bruised mushrooms before fading to a surface grave. Hemlock roots grasp cantilevered rocks. Shadows interlock trees, becoming undone, and I trudge along, oblivious to myself. Now, I think what the poet does here, what Joseph Caldwell does, is put us right out on the trail, right out in nature, and then there's this surprising turn at the end where he places himself there, the poet sort of appears. And to me, that sort of thing is quite wonderful. In other Joseph Caldwell poems, he basically tells me about West Virginia. I've lived here now for almost 30 years, and I feel closer to West Virginia reading Joseph Caldwell poems than I do getting in my car and driving to Walmart. So I find that very, very much real world, and I think poets are, I think part of the stereotype is that poets aren't a part of the real world when they actually are. In fact, they may be better observers of it than most of us are.
Yeah. Well, Carl, would you like to read something at this point, Carl?
I would. I'd like to read a couple, if you'll let me.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. This is called Stones. At Pebble Beach in Marathon, a boy wearing a bike helmet pedaled up and warned Walker and Morgan not to swim because a man had drowned there yesterday. He'd watched the volunteer fireman hoist the body over the driftwood and up the hill. He needn't have worried. None of us were going near the freezing waters of Lake Superior. When the boy came with this message, I was already on the beach. I just wanted rocks, marble veined with hematite, flecked with fool's gold, tumbled round as grapefruit. The colors of the wet stones dazzled me, inspired greed. When the stones dried, their colors paled, and I could no longer remember why I wanted them so. On the way back to Highway 17, looking for a place to dump our beer bottles, I noticed a burnt house on the street where the boy lived. Not yet 7, and he'd already witnessed so much disaster, each insult abrading the rough spots of his desire until it's smooth and blue and perfectly round. This is called Your Father's Ghost. Ed is concerned that I'm using the sprinklers, worried that the pump will break or the well run out of water. He shows me that this spring, the irises have bloomed in their mantles of purple, as if seaborne, even before the snowdrops have broken the crust of the February dirt. He asks me what I do at work. If I sit in a room by myself all day, worried I might be lonely, and I tell him that it's not so sad. It's not unlike his old job as a postmaster, being a lawyer, learning of the people and their troubles. You'll be glad to know your father looks well, and that even in death attends to his yard and kin.
You, David?
Yes.
Could we ask Carl if he could read Day of the Dead?
Okay. A request. Right. And these are the last two, for people who are listening, the last two poems were poems of Carl's. This next from the collection, from the first collection, Kettle, right?
That last one was from a collection that's called Home Geography that's coming up here.
Okay.
Thanks, Jim, for the request. This is okay.
I like this one very much.
All right. Day of the Dead. Smooth rocks worn by water, graves to mark the dead. The living have left their painted names upon the fields of stone. Secret messages, handprints, farewells. I move beyond the markers, past the freight cars packed with circus animals, past the incense cedars down to the intractable ropes of kelp. Dig my hairy toes into the shore, skip a stone towards Japan, and count the circles.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now this this sounds like this was a poem that just actually grew out of your experience. It's like you're telling us about something that actually happened to you. Is this a journalistic account?
Interestingly enough, that one really is more like a dream poem, and I don't write so many of those right now, but sometimes those work and sometimes they don't. And the other poems were much more journalistic. The first two that I read were the poem about rocks, you know, collecting stones up in Lake Superior. And it's journalistic in a way, but it has a deeper meaning for me and maybe for a reader. And the same with the poem about my father-in-law's ghost. I send out to my mother-in-law, who might be listening to this. Some poems grow directly out of experience, and some are more out of dreams or a sort of a stream of consciousness. Hopefully, those have some meaning to readers too.
I want to. We have some other calls I want to get right to, and I think I also should again introduce our guests. Here in studio with me is Carl Reisman. He is an attorney here in Champaign-Urbana, has a practice where he works in workers' comp and personal injury. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois Law School and also is a poet, and was a poet before he was a lawyer. And he got the idea to try to organize a conference, and as far as anybody seems to know, it's the first one that's ever happened anywhere, a conference looking at poetry and the law. It is taking place on the U of I campus at the law school tomorrow and Friday. And joining us by telephone is James Elkins. He's a professor at West Virginia University College of Law and has written about a number of different things, including law and psychiatry and lawyers and film. And also, he's editor of the first compilation of the work of poet lawyers, Off the Record, an anthology of poetry by lawyers. It was published in 2004. And as I said in the beginning, some people might think that these were two worlds that just can't come together. But in fact, in the preface to that collection, he does indeed make the point that here, going back long way in American history, we have always had lawyer poets and poet lawyers. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with some other people who are listening. Line 2 is next in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. A poem I recently ran across, which I think is very beautiful. In 1861, The Battle Hymn of the Republic by Julia Ward Howe, and it goes, "In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free while God is marching on." That's Julia Ward Howe.
Well, all right. Well, thanks for sharing that.
Thank you.
Let's go on. Let's talk with someone in Mattoon. This is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning,
yeah.
And let me start off by saying I've not been able to give 100% of my attention to the show this morning, so please excuse me you've already addressed this point, but are there lawyers who write poetry about the law? I mean, most of what I've been able to listen to is kind of like, okay, I'm away from the office, and I have a life outside of being an attorney, and that's what I'm going to write about, But I'm just wondering if there are attorneys or lawyers or judges who write poetry about what they do professionally.
Well, it's not, I think you, James Elkins can pick up on that. Again, I think you were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that you've collected the work of a lot of poets who happen to be lawyers, and they almost never seem to write about, directly write about being a lawyer or being in the courtroom or legal issues, right?
Well, it's certainly the case that generally lawyer poets, when they set out to do poetry, write about things other than law and lawyers, although it's certainly not always true. And there are some lawyers around the country who do write about law and lawyers. There's a lawyer in Seattle named Daniel Kane, who writes verse about law and lawyering, and I found out about his work because it was published in the Washington Bar Journal, a kind of professional journal of lawyers. And there are other poets who write about the law. There's a public defender, for example, named Richard Bank in Philadelphia, and he writes poems sometimes about the law. So it's certainly not the case. And this is true historically as well. There's a poet named John Godfrey Saxe who frequently wrote about the law. So some lawyer poets do write a poem or two about the law. And sometimes you'll find a collection, and in fact, the ones I find most intriguing are those historical lawyer poets, and you'll pick up a volume of their work, a collection of 200 or 300 pages, and maybe there'll be one single poem about being a lawyer in some fashion. And, of course, that wouldn't tip off the general reader to the fact that the author or poet was a lawyer, but having, in my case, knowing that they are makes the poem all the more meaningful. So it's certainly the case that some lawyer poets do write about law and lawyering.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left here in this part of Focus 580, and folks who are listening to the program are certainly welcome to call with questions, with comments. Oh, and Jason, I think we had a new caller there, and I bumped the person off. My apologies to the caller in Effingham. I didn't realize that was a new call. I hope
David,
that they will call back. Yes, sir.
Our one caller quoted quite well the poem, The Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And I might point out to listeners that the Star-Spangled Banner it was written by Francis Scott Key, who was a lawyer. And so when we start looking back at history, we find that lawyers have all along the way been such a prominent part of our literary heritage. And indeed, they still are. And to me, that's been the most exciting part of my work.
Very good. Well, I want to include this caller from Effingham here on line number one. My apologies, I bumped you off the air, not intentionally, but I did it. So I'm glad to have you with us, caller. Go ahead.
That's all right. I am neither a poet nor a lawyer, although I know a number of both. I'm in Illinois. I'm from Louisiana, and I am familiar with the works of John William Carrington, whose works are collected, I believe. Are collected at Centenary College.
Yes, Connor, go ahead. We're getting some kind of odd feedback there. I'm not sure why, but yes, we did. I think we got you. Go ahead.
Okay, I wasn't sure you were hearing me.
Yes, yeah, we were hearing you.
I'd like your guest to say more about John William Carrington. I believe there's a library on the College of Centenary College in Shreveport, Louisiana, built around his works.
Well, the caller's right. John William Carrington moved to Shreveport when he was about 11 or 12 years old and basically fell in love with the place. Carrington very much wanted to think of himself as a Southerner. In fact, he actually lied about the place of his birth. He was born in Ohio, but he was so taken by the South as a young man growing up in Shreveport that he told biographers that he was born in the South because he didn't want to be associated with Yankees. But his papers are collected at Centenary College in Shreveport. And I think John William Corrington is one of the great undiscovered writers of legal fiction in the 20th century. He tragically died at a young age. He died at 58, but he's an incredibly interesting man. Here was an English professor, a poet, a novelist. He wrote screenplays. When he was a freshman in law school, he wrote with Joyce Corrington, his wife, the screenplay for the Battle of the Planet of the Apes. Here he is, a freshman law student, and he's writing a screenplay. And then he went on to write TV soap operas. But he was also philosophically inclined, and he was a very, very interesting man. And so it was Corrington and the fact that he was a poet and trying to figure out what that meant in terms of his life that got me interested in him. But for readers who are interested, his work is now all out of print, except for his detective mysteries. He wrote some police detective mysteries, a series of four with his wife, Joyce Corrington, who, by the way, he wrote with. And Joyce Corrington was in fact, she's still alive. Mrs. Corrington had a Ph.D. in molecular chemistry and got pulled into the web of the writing life that her husband was leading and ended up as a writer for MTV's Real World, where she's just retired. So John William Corrington is a very, very important Southern figure, and I think is largely unknown as a writer of some extremely, extremely good fiction, including legal fiction. And he was also a very, very good poet.
Is the caller still there? Did they get your question?
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Maybe this conference will help change that, the fact of his not being well known.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that listeners might want to know is that Corrington's collected works are available. ABBooks.com is a source that I use routinely to find out-of-print books. And Corrington's collected stories are available. And they can also use a Google search to find his legal fiction, which I published some years ago with Mrs. Corrington's permission. And we've got all of that. All of his legal fiction is now up on the web, so readers can find it there as well.
Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. We are coming down to about our last 5 or 6 minutes here in this hour of Focus 580, talking about poetry and the law, which is going to be the subject of a conference taking place, a symposium taking place here on the U of I campus Thursday, Friday. The law school's a sponsor. I think I really should mention, I know I haven't all along, the MFA Creative Writing Program, which is a co-sponsor. Have to acknowledge them. And here in studio with me is Carl Reisman. He's a poet and a local attorney and was the organizer of this conference. Is there anything in particular that you, for people who are listening to us, who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, who might think about taking part in this, anything in particular you would like to say about specifically about the conference?
Absolutely. It's going to be starts at 4:30 tomorrow at the law school, which is on Pennsylvania and 6th in Champaign. It's free and open to the public. It'll go for about an hour and a half tomorrow in room A of the law school. And then it's going to be all day on Friday, starting at about 9:30 at Channing Murray Foundation. It's going to move from the law school because they've got a national trial advocacy competition going on and a bunch of law students coming in from all over the country. So we're getting booted out of the law school. But Channing Murray is a beautiful chapel and be a great place to hear. Here are participants. We've got a number of very interesting poets coming in for the conference. Evie Shockley is a poet, former environmental lawyer for Sid Lane Austin, Chicago. She teaches at Rutgers University. Tim Nolan is an attorney up in Minneapolis who's a former editor of the Paris Review, an excellent poet in his right. Rachel Contrini Flynn is a corporate lawyer in Chicago. She won the Dorset Prize in 2003, which is a prestigious literary prize and writes very beautiful poetry. Frank Pommersheim is a professor at University of South Dakota College of Law, and he's a tribal court justice as well as a law professor, and he writes poetry. Hopefully, Mr. Elkins will make it out here. We're praying on good weather for travel, but if not, he's here in right now on the phone, and his good work has propelled this whole thing along from the very start.
Okay. So it sounds like most of the events will be taking place on Friday at Channing Murray, and if someone just felt like stopping by, they should feel welcome just to stop by.
Absolutely. It's free. It's open to the public. You can go to law.uic.edu and see the schedule on the web. You don't need to be a lawyer or a poet to enjoy hearing the readings and the panel discussions. There's also going to be a writer's workshop that takes place. And at the end of the day, there will be readings by some of the MFA creative writing students also. And so we just hope people brave the weather and come out to
good
the
day,
event.
Good day,
David.
Poetry. Yes, sir.
Carl and the organizers of the conference have really done a marvelous job, and the poet lawyers that they've selected to come are all really quite good. And in fact, he mentioned Frank Pommersheim, and Pommersheim's poetry is really, really quite incredible. He tends to write short haiku-influenced poems, and I might, in view of the fact that I'm snowbound here in West Virginia, and it's increasingly looking like that I'm not going to be able to be at the conference, I might just read a little very short poem by Pommersheim. It's called Bigfoot Memorial Ride Haiku, and this is the entire poem. Lakota ponies and blue ghost of memory fill the snowy sky.
Very nice. That's very nice. Well, this will be a good way to spend a cold, snowy Friday. Be inside listening to poetry, talking about writing. Channing Murray on Friday, starting at 8:45 in the morning. And as Carl said, anybody who is interested should certainly feel welcome to stop by. We're almost at the point where we have to finish here. We have a couple of minutes. I was interested in asking Professor Elkins, I'm just thinking about legal education and about the fact that, you know, people come to law school with already an undergraduate degree in something. And it could be just about anything, I guess. And then when you get to law school, what it is you concentrate is on law. You learn the legal history, you learn the law, you learn about being a lawyer, you learn about making arguments, you have practice courtroom sessions, you do all that kind of thing. Do you think that there's some room for trying to cultivate in people something else, or does the law school simply have to say, well, that you're kind of on your own on that? We're here to teach you the law, and if you want to be a writer, you want to whatever else is going on in your life, that's kind of up to you. Does the law school have any sort of point in promoting, trying to encourage people to have lives other than law?
Well, I think it does. In fact, one of the things that we know is that law is really quite powerful, and we also know that it's quite limiting. One of the things that we've discovered in the last quarter century is that the law is a kind of crossroads discipline. We no longer study law as if the law were a sovereign nation all apart from all the others. In fact, law is now viewed, to think about law, to understand law now as something beyond a technical body of rules. We have to think about it in terms of the social sciences, the humanities, the liberal arts. And one of the things that law students know, many law students know profoundly, is that law is simply not enough. And one way to think about law is that it's like a big box, and you climb into it, and you can live in that box. But one of the things that many lawyers know is that they've got to have a way to see out and beyond the box. And I think poetry serves that purpose. So one of the things that we've done here at West Virginia for a good number of years, in fact, ever since I've been here, we teach perspective courses in which we require students to think broadly and deeply about the law. And so the more law becomes specialized and the more lawyers become gain valuable expertise, the more they need to have the breadth of vision and depth of knowledge that comes from realizing that law is never really quite enough to function well in the world that that even lawyers live in.
Yeah. You would like to add anything to that, Carl?
One of the reasons I thought it would be a good idea to have this conference is I was thinking along those lines, but not as my thoughts weren't as eloquent as your words, Jim. When I was in Ireland last summer, I just happened to be staying somewhere where I was just about a half a mile from the ruins of a bardic school, and the young Irish bards in medieval times had studied law, history, and poetry as part of legal education. And I started to think that it would make sense to humanize the legal education here too.
Well, there we must stop because we've come to the end of the time. Again, we want to thank our guest, James Elkins. He's professor at West Virginia University College of Law, been there since 1981, and is, among other things, the editor of the first compilation of the work of poet lawyers, Off the Record, an anthology of poetry by lawyers. And Professor Elkins, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
And here in the studio with me is Carl Reisman. He's a local attorney and also a poet. Two published collections, at least two, Home Geography and Kettle. And he is one of the organizers of this conference that we've talked about, going to take place on the U of I campus. The first session on Thursday afternoon at the law school, and then all day Friday at the Channing Murray Foundation. Opening Arguments, Poetry and the Law. And it's co-sponsored by the law school and the U of I MFA Creative Writing Program. And as we said, anybody who wants to stop by can do that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's wonderful to be here.